We eat, and sometimes we are eaten. One of the things that certainly is eating away at us these days is acquired immune deficiency syndrome, or AIDS. As the name suggests, AIDS is a syndrome in which our immune system collapses, leaving us vulnerable to whatever little bug happens to come along to eat away at us. Orthodox wisdom suggests that AIDS is caused by a human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV. We become infected with this virus, it is said, through the contaminated blood of others. AIDS has killed an estimated 25 million people since it was first recognized in 1981, and currently accounts for an estimated 80% of all American financial aid to world health and population issues. Yet an increasing number are pointing to the enormity of this pandemic and questioning our basic assumptions about it. Does HIV really cause AIDS? Do AIDS drugs really work? Should we give all our money to AIDS when dysentery kills five times more children? The Orthodox call these dissenters denialists. And today we pause to ask, should we deny the denialists their denials?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 615th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in San Jose del Cabo who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with Dave Michaels on the boards, and Mikey too.
Hello, glad David to be here. Both of us glad to be here.
All right. Parmalee Taff.
Hello.
And riding along with me today, we have producer Carol Stafford.
Hello.
Who we can blame for this show, because she's the one that's been tugging on my shirt sleeves for the last 3 years, saying, we got to do this show. And today we're going to do it. Folks, AIDS has become a very big deal since it was first defined in 1981. AIDS has cost you and I 25 million of our fellow human beings and robbed us of 100 billion or so of our monies. Though we have built up an orthodox wisdom about this disease, some have come to dissent. These dissenters are called by the orthodox the denialists. Listen to how the denialists are defined in Wikipedia. Some individuals, including some scientists who are not recognized experts on HIV, question the connection between HIV and AIDS. Some question the procedures used to prove the existence of HIV. Others question the validity of current testing and treatment methods. These claims have been examined and rejected as having no validity. And so the question comes to mind, should we listen to the denialist, or should we accept the orthodox and deny the denialists their denials? Here to help us search for an answer, we have Celia Farber, who is the author of Serious Adverse Events, An Uncensored History of AIDS. Celia, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Good to have you aboard. You have become a very famous chronicler of dissent on AIDS. You don't call yourself a denialist, though, do you?
No, not at all. It's an incredibly ironic term to be labeled with when my self-description of what I have done is, well, exactly what you said. I've chronicled the road forked off in 1987 between the orthodoxy and the dissident or dissenting point of view. And I was a young journalist at the time. I had a column that was all about AIDS each month in Spin magazine. And there's a backstory to that, but never mind for now. I followed the fork in the road. I followed the dissenting view, feeling it was very important and very interesting. As in the climate of this dialectic, as soon as you even chronicle the dissent, you become a, quote, denialist, and you're accused of giving sympathetic portrayal. What you're actually giving is portrayal, period.
Mm-hmm.
I might even say objective portrayal. Over time, you become so under attack yourself that you actually become part of the story in this extra-dimensional way that's incredibly unusual.
Well, am I going to become a denialist because I'm featuring Celia Farber?
I don't think so. I actually think, honestly, Michael, I think this pogrom mentality is fading, and there are so many people now really delving into this and trying to unpack it and understand it,
mm-hmm.
that the entire orthodoxy would have to busy itself 24/7 to go after everybody who's taking an interest.
Carol handed me a little piece about an organization called The Group. 2,000 people signed a petition asking that we revise how we look at AIDS, among them Nobel laureates in chemistry and biology and whatnot. So it seems like the voices of dissent are louder and louder all the time as we go along. But I'd like to go back to the beginning and help and have you help us understand AIDS and HIV and the whole milieu, and perhaps we can make it simple enough for me to understand, which is no easy function. Let's start with the gay man in San Francisco who began showing up, I think it was in the early 1980s, with weird lesions on their bodies.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the first of it, was it not?
Actually, I want to say straight off the bat, for people who really are interested and willing to take this on, there's a book that delves in incredible depth into the very first 11 cases of AIDS. It's called When AIDS Began by a PhD scholar named Michelle Cochran.
Mm-hmm.
And among her discoveries, I mean, she's really talking about how the San Francisco Department of Health came to construct this disease. There's so much in this. There's so much sociology and politics and complexity of what was going on in America in post-Stonewall and the beginning of gay liberation and all of the homophobia that was raging and all of the very good reasons people had for wanting to keep certain epidemiological discussions under wraps.
Right.
But what Michelle Cochran revealed in this book is that in the very first cases, first of all, I mean, this notion of previously healthy gay men, well, I don't know exactly what the numbers are, but a good number of these first 11 cases, first of all, were homeless. So there you have, no nutrition,
no
love, no nothing, right? They were homeless and or heroin addicts and or gay men.
So did this, when we first looked at these cases, did we call it AIDS? Was it?
It was called GRID originally.
GRID.
Gay-related immune deficiency.
Oh, okay. All right.
Well,
that probably made the gay community kind of upset then, too, that there would be a disease associated with being gay.
Well, it wasn't associated with being gay, but I think what would have been important to stick with epidemiologically is what were the potential assaults on the immune system associated with being gay and being somebody who, I want to devoutly avoid the word lifestyle, but who...
How can you?
You can't. Okay. Who practiced a certain lifestyle, and that lifestyle brought with it so many extreme dangers and assaults to the immune system. Like, it wasn't sex. It wasn't sex per se, but the culture around bathhouse gay sex that brought with it extreme use of both poppers and other recreational drugs. Again, a total lack of nutrition, lack of sleep, lots of antibiotics. And again, I have to say the psycho-spiritual dynamic of it is that these are people who were kind of shut off and cut out from society and had formed their own society. And that in and of itself, I asked a Colombian physician named Roberto Giraldo, who's traveled the world and treated immune deficiency. He is a dissident. And I said, Roberto, of everybody you've seen and treated and spoken to, what is it really that would, if there's one thing that could pull people out of this, what would you say that it is? And he said, oh, that's easy. One word, love.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So here we have a population of people who are very sick. They have suffered a collapse of their immune system, and they have a variety of different problems, leaving everybody to scratch their head, wondering what on earth is happening. Then along comes a guy named Dr. Robert Gallo, who says, I have found the answer. And when we come back from this break, we will pick up what that answer was supposed to be with Celia Farber, who is the author of Serious Adverse Events and Uncensored History of AIDS. Please do stay tuned, because we will be right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back. This is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson. Today, we're talking about a very, very serious subject, AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, which has cost you and I 25 million of our fellow human beings and billions and billions and billions of dollars out of our monies. AIDS is caused, it is said, by a virus, the human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV. But wait, some are saying maybe that's not the case. And a lot of people look at these dissenters and call them weird names, like the denialists. And they deny their denials and turn away from them. But today we're looking at them and asking the question, should we deny the denialists like the Orthodox, or should we lend them an ear? What do you think? Curious to hear what you have to say. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We're with Celia Farber, author of Serious Adverse Events, An Uncensored History of AIDS. Celia, 1984, Robert Gallo discovers the cause of AIDS, right?
Oh, boy. what happened is that part of the history is actually now finally being, it's as if we've wound our way backwards and we're now at the center of the labyrinth. There's a new book out called Fear of the Invisible by a fantastic British journalist named Janine Roberts. And, she has uncovered the documents that are at the very the very first documents that we would really want to look at, how, because this 20 some years of warfare and debate really over whether we should have this debate, you know, as you correctly stated at the outset, there's always been a void at the center of it, and the void is what did they have in the very beginning. And it's almost so shocking that even I reel back from it. I can't believe it.
What do you mean at the very beginning? What did they have?
At the very beginning in 1983.
Mm-hmm. This is when Dr. Robert Gallo's looking for the cause of AIDS, right?
Yeah. First of all, let me wind us back just a little bit further, and I'll try to do this succinctly. There was a climate. There was the perfect storm. There were several things going on. Number one, retrovirology was in its not its earliest years, but in the phase of its development where it was very eager to justify itself and to make itself grow. And there was no retrovirus that had been pinned to any disease, animal or human. Yet there was a passion, a belief that this was the new class of viruses that was going to become hugely significant in virology. So it really was the tail wagging the dog, right?
Sure. So we were out looking for a retrovirus.
Yeah, if you read Randy Schultz's book and The Band Played On, it's all there. He talks about this this generation of virologists who were and the way they were sort of storming around the corridors of the CDC and the NIH, more or less saying, it's going to be a retrovirus, and we're going to find it. This thing is a retrovirus, is caused by a retrovirus. And it's kind of phenomenal, and you can see how that sort of will really obliterate that kind of political and financial and ego-based, you know, passion and urge, obliterates the kind of cool, laconic, observation-based science that we would have needed in this situation.
So what you're saying is that we really wanted to find a retrovirus as the cause of
absolutely.
AIDS.
Absolutely.
So we were essentially begging.
Absolutely.
Begging for this. So Robert,
and
Dr.
Bob
Robert Gallo
and,
found
and,
one?
And Bob Gallo, being Bob Gallo, having already pushed members of his HTLV viral family, he was pinning HTLV viruses on diseases all over the place. But his original attempt to pin HIV was actually on leukemia, which is the opposite of AIDS cellularly. So if you look at this history, it's a fascinating kind of chaos, and you just want, it's cacophony is what it is. Like, these ideas aren't making sense. They're not linear. They're not scientific. Very strange climate going on. At the same time, Robert Gallo and the NCI reigned supreme over the world of virology, not just the United States, but internationally, which is why we had this episode where Luc Montagnier sent his sample to Robert Gallo. That became a huge investigation that really still is ongoing. The myth that formed is that Gallo, quote, stole the virus from the French.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Carol Stafford pointed out an interesting thing before our radio show today when we were discussing the subject. And she said that Dr. Robert Gallo did not name it HIV, but actually the name was kind of cadged together.
That's
at the
right.
White House.
It was a fusion name. Between the name for the French sample was LAV, and Gallo's name was HTLV3 for what he called his virus. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry for your listeners that this gets so Byzantine, but We'll work our way through it.
Okay.
Anyway, they politically fused the name into the diplomatic middle ground, HIV, human immunodeficiency virus.
And there was an economic reason for this, correct?
Absolutely. The U.S. government, I believe the day before they had their famous press conference declaring that the United States had found the cause of AIDS, had, of course, patented the first test for HIV. And really, this is where to begin to if you look at the earliest history, what I think is most important is how did they build the test around the, quote, new virus, the proteins that were said to compose the new virus. And that's something very important. We're not talking about a classical viral entity here. We're talking about a postmodern, almost laboratory construction that comes into being through the technologies that are developed to find it. Does that make sense?
So, not quite.
Okay.
but that's not the only thing that doesn't make sense about all of this here.
This is another show, and I'm just going to kind of gloss over it. But the people believe there's a virus and there's a test for the virus.
Mm-hmm.
There is no gold standard, which is why the HIV test is so problematic. From country to country, from lab to lab, there, last count, I may be wrong in this, there were at least 11 different criteria by which the same blood sample can be positive or negative or indeterminate in a different country. So the qualifications for this are more stringent, actually, believe it or not, in certain Western countries, and they're much less stringent in Africa. So it is much easier to test HIV positive in, say, Uganda than it is in, say, you know, Sydney, Australia.
Well, good, because we're going to get to the famous Uganda study down the line when we talk about some of the denialists like Dr. Peter Duisburg from Berkeley,
yeah.
Dr. Jonathan Watt Fishbein.
Yep.
I realized
I was getting way too esoteric, and I just want to, for your listeners, clarify something very basic about why we're in this mess and why there's such
good.
A debate. Robert Gallo's original cohort, fewer than half of them actually tested positive for the sample even at the time. In other words, there wasn't even a 100% correlation between those who had the illness and those who had what was now said to be the causative agent. That violates the first of Koch's postulates.
Mm-hmm.
Many people believe Koch's postulates, the rules determining whether an organism causes a disease, should be abandoned. Other people say they stand as a very important way to measure whether an organism causes a disease. But in any case, even that wasn't fulfilled, which begs the question, how could this possibly have flown?
Because we wanted to find something. Right?
Yeah.
Essentially what you're saying is that we wanted to find what we were looking for. And if we had to perhaps cut a corner or two to see it, we were willing to do that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, and as everybody
we have to take a quick break.
Okay.
Hold on to that. We will be right back. And when we come back, let's look at the denialists themselves. Michael Olson, this is The Food Chain. Do stay tuned. Way back there in 1984, Dr. Robert Gallo discovered what he said was the cause of AIDS, or acquired immune deficiency syndrome. He said it was a virus. And you pick up that virus through the contaminated blood. Or did he know, Celia Farber, where this virus came from?
No, they speculated rather insanely that it came from Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't we still
speculating that too?
Yeah, of course. Africa has to be the blame dumping ground for everything, and has to be exploited and used for everything in this mess.
Okay.
All diseases are either infectious or environmental. And doing the work that you do, I'm sure you know quite a bit about how sickness occurs and how important the whole environment of the organism is. And really, that's all this comes down to. It's like any other search for the true cause of any other disease. We are just coming out of the age of viral obsession and mania, the belief that single germs are demonic and capable of causing incredibly elaborate diseases, and that the viruses in question have a demonic brilliance to them, and they can do all kinds of things that are completely unheard of, and nobody can conquer them. I think that's what we're gonna be talking about when we look back at this age. What was that religion? Where did it come from? It doesn't come from any sound understanding of life. If the conditions for life are met, the organism is going to thrive. And vice versa.
And what Dr. Gallo said was that it's a virus. And what others, the dissidents, seem to be saying is that, well, wait a minute, perhaps it's the environment or something that we are doing to cause this.
A lot of scientists at the time looked at that. I know many scientists who didn't even go to the press conference because they thought it was such hogwash. Those who are at the press conference who remember it speak of a kind of a spell being cast. And it happened very quickly, and there was this moment when people could have spoken up and said, wait a minute, where's your proof? Where are your experiments? How do you know this? But somehow nobody did, and it is said that in the New York Times it was first called the probable cause of AIDS, and within a few days the word probable fell away. And ever since then we've been dealing with a spell. We've been dealing with
But that was
a belief system.
It was a very interesting spell because it created a couple of interesting situations. Situation number one is that because it was a virus, it kind of changed the nature of the gay-related, what was the grid called?
Yeah. It was politically expedient, and it superficially resolved a lot of tensions in the culture. The dissidents are accused of being homophobic for saying that the conditions of fast lane bathhouse gay culture could make people sick, as opposed to a virus that you just catch making people sick.
So a virus, anybody could catch the virus then, right?
Anybody could, and then this whole other part of the religion became, you know, in a sense, all about whether people were guilty or innocent. And I'm more interested in why did people get sick, because that's the only way to figure out how can people get well.
Now, the other thing it did was it created a whole industry of testing. Because it's a virus, now we can run around and conduct virus experiments and virus tests and virus studies, right?
Yes, it's a colossal industry, and it was the orthodoxy that said on World AIDS Day, in an article that came out on the wires, that quote, we have created a monster, and what they were saying was, AIDS has become a monstrous industry that needs to feed itself and needs to sustain itself, and other diseases, as you said, that kill way more people, especially in the developing world, are being underfunded and ignored. They're not sexy. They're not. It's not where the action is. It's not where the money is. And this juggernaut, regardless of what one may think about causation, has definitely metastasized to the point of absurdity. And so I actually think most of us at heart are dissidents. There are so many aspects of this to decry. Causation is one very hot button issue, but there's so much else. I mean, the corruption, the funding, the human exploitation, the exploitation of Africa. It's kind of infinite. You know, there's a lot to be unhappy about in this case.
I can see that. Well, let's talk about some of the denialists. Let's go to Dr. Peter Duisberg from Cal Berkeley, who in a 1987 paper said, "Hey, HIV cannot cause AIDS."
Right. He said that as the one of the world's leading retrovirologists, which he was
a Wow, that's kind of like, that was a talk about dissident, that's or a denial, that's pretty unequivocal.
Yeah, he was unequivocal, and he remains unequivocal, and here is what he said. He said, retroviruses as a class of viruses, as we all know, are non-pathogenic. And it is true to say that prior to the 1984 press conference, if you asked a retrovirologist, are retroviruses pathogenic, they would have said no. They are latent. They are not pathogenic. There was a hope that they would become pathogenic, i.e. significant, but no, prior to AIDS, nobody had ever said that they were. So Duisberg was really just sticking with the class of... Staying on that side of the bridge where they all were prior to the press conference.
Before everybody ran over, stampeded over on the other side.
Stampeded to the other side.
So is this Dr. Peter Duisberg a legit guy? I mean, is he for real?
He's absolutely was. I'm going to put this in historical context. He was considered one of the top scientists in the United States. When he wrote his 1987 paper, after that he became pariahed and attacked and marginalized and defunded. And now his name is so full of all kinds of political connotations, it's almost impossible to peg him anymore as a scientist. But I did, my original work for Harper's was actually an article that was called The Passion of Peter Duisberg. And it was all about Duisberg's science, and I got many quotes from all over the world from people in the cancer field who have been following him very closely, who think he's one of the geniuses of cancer genetics. And he does have a new theory of cancer that is being adopted, however tortuously, by the cancer establishment.
So he's a legitimate scientist.
Absolutely.
Who became illegitimate because he denied the orthodox wisdom.
Yes, absolutely. And we are in the dark ages. We have not progressed at all when it comes to, you know, we read stories about scientists from the past who were driven to suicide or crucified or put under house arrest. It still goes on. It still goes. Nothing has changed in that regard. And but Duesberg continues to do his cancer work, and he does so, you know, under very, very difficult conditions, but he's a pure classical scientist, and really science is all he's interested in. So he's incapable of responding sociologically or politically. He doesn't really know what any of that means. He just responds, this is the data I see, and this is what the conclusions I draw from it. So he's behaving, again, the word is classical. That's old-fashioned science. That's not how science is done anymore. Science today is driven by commerce and industry.
Well, then,
and also
speaking of commerce and industry, let's look at the famous Uganda study and Dr. Jonathan Fishbein when we come back to talk about the denialists of AIDS and the relationship of HIV to AIDS and the whole industry, I guess, when it gets right down to it. They call them the denialists. Should we deny them their denials? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080, right back. Welcome back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking with Celia Farmer about the denialists, people who disagree with the orthodox wisdom about AIDS. And we're talking about why they disagree, and we're wondering whether we should allow them to disagree, because that really is the question when it comes to the political correctness of I don't know. You know, when I studied Chinese, I watched the Red Guards, because the Red Guards, when somebody would disagree with them, they would shout them down. They would bring them in before a whole Congress of people, of Red Guards, and they would shout at them, and they would shout them down, and then they would chop their heads off or send them away to the countryside. And whenever I see that kind of behavior, I just get frightened. And when it was pointed out to me that there was this kind of behavior going on in the world of AIDS, I just said, let's look at it. And that's what we're doing today. Celia Farmer, is that a pretty good description of it, Celia?
It's a perfect description, Michael. And you've just put a circle around the most important thing I want people to look at in this thing, and that is the social and political dynamics of the debate. And without exception, the dissenters, and I've followed them closely since 1987, without exception, they have acted scientifically and rationally and very humanely, and they have asked for a forum, asked for a debate, tried to get letters published. All these things are not only thwarted and blocked, but shamed, and I mean, there's a true bona fide McCarthy-esque witch hunt afoot, and every significant dissenter has been tarred and feathered. They've gotten people fired from their jobs at universities.
Let's pick up one of them. Let's pick up Dr. Jonathan Fishbein, who was a very significant person in the field of our national health system. Correct?
That's correct. He was. He was. He actually came out of the pharmaceutical industry, Fishbein, and went over to work in government because he wanted to. He thought he could do more good there.
And when he was hired to oversee the epidemiological studies of AIDS and HIV, he went to work for the government and discovered there were already, 4,000 studies being conducted?
Yeah, that's right. He went to work for the Division of AIDS, and there were thousands of studies being conducted
already
all around the world. And he found that nobody was flying the plane. Nobody was doing oversight. He was hired after the plane was airborne, so to speak, to do oversight to make sure that those clinical trials were safe and that the people in them were safe.
And so he took a look at a study being conducted in Uganda. Tell us about that.
Yeah, HIVnet 012. Have to shorten this. Basically, it was one of the studies that was all of the studies that he looked at were racked with problems. But this one, as soon as he came, his first day on the job, people came into his office and closed the doors and said, you know, this study is really a nightmare. And it was particularly ominous. There was a lot of pressure on it. It was a study that was designed to launch I don't know if your listeners are familiar with it, the climate we're in. Studies are paid for by the pharmaceutical industry, and they are designed to launch blockbuster drugs. Studies are not done by designed by independent sources so that they can get the right answer about a drug. They're designed to launch a drug. So this was the pinnacle study that was to launch the drug called nevirapine, which is a very toxic and very crude and bad and dangerous drug that was rejected by health authorities in every Western nation and was poised to be launched across the developing world for pregnant women. To block passage of HIV from mother to child.
Wait a minute. Have they ever figured out if there is an HIV virus?
Oh, boy. do we have another?
That's a can of worms.
16 hours?
Well, just tell me.
There's a faction within the dissenting community that argues that HIV has never been proven to exist by classical viral isolation. Duisberg has said it exists. They did isolate it, but it is pathogenic, ordinary, and harmless, not worth talking about. That's a major rift in the dissident community. Does the virus exist or doesn't it?
So when it gets down to it, it may or may not exist. We're not really sure. Would that be a...
Exactly. And it sounds like a science fiction novel, doesn't it?
So, with respect to this study in Uganda, what was bad about it?
everything. It was.
Mm-hmm.
Was it
a double-blind study?
Rampant corruption. No, there was double blind. I mean, there were babies who died in that. They would put babies in cribs. They didn't know which one was which. The babies died. Mothers died. Entire file cabinets were lost in floods. The guys who were supposed to access the documents in the hospitals were so corrupt they had to be paid to open the drawers. It was just unbelievable, hair-raising stuff. Like, all the conditions you would expect for a trial to be found were violated.
And yet, what happened to the...
The results were cooked. The results were the woman who was charged at DAIDS with writing up the results of the study had her was removed and her I'm not going to name any names right
now. And then
here,
what
right
happened
now,
to Jonathan
it was
Fishbein?
Taken over and the study conclusions were reversed.
What happened to Jonathan Fishbein?
Jonathan Fishbein had the classic trajectory of a whistleblower. He blew the whistle and he paid a very dear price. And he was they were not able to fire him. But they iced him, so to speak.
Okay, then we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, the other dissenter, President Thabo Mbeki of South Africa. Do stay tuned. We will be right back with Celia Farber, author of Serious Adverse Events, An Uncensored History of AIDS. Right back. Thabo Mbeki was the president of South Africa who did not believe in the orthodoxy, listening to the dissidents or the... And suggested that we're not going to participate in the AIDS studies being conducted throughout Africa. Tell us a little bit about the president, Celia Farber.
I'm a great admirer of Thabo Mbeki. Mm-hmm. What he actually did was he called for a meeting, and I attended. I went to Pretoria. This was in... Good heavens, what year was it? 2000. And he invited 12 scientists from the dissenting side and 12 from the orthodox side to attend a three-day conference and sit at a long conference table and provide their best data so that he and the Health Ministry of South Africa could decide, following that, what would be the best course of treatment for South Africans who test HIV positive. He never did say, I accept or agree with the dissidents. He said, I accept that there is a question, and I want to answer it thoroughly for my people. That's all Thabo Mbeki ever did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the crime for which he was crucified. And I mean, this is just Socratic dialogue.
I just had a suggestion that Thabo Mbeki... denied the AIDS drugs and suggested that his citizens instead cure themselves with peanut butter and raisins. And that this Thabo is kind of a wacko. Do you?
That's the extraordinary demonic work of a cadre of propagandists who put dunce caps. You know, back to what you said about the Red Guard. I can no more address that than I can address, you know, somebody who's been made to wear a dunce cap. It's so far from the reality of what he's a reader, an intellectual, a thinker, an economist, one of the champion fighters of apartheid. He and his father, of course, Governor Mbeki, who sat in prison with Mandela. The trashing of Thabo Mbeki is so mind-boggling and frankly so racist.
So when it gets right down to it, we have two courses of action with respect to AIDS. One course suggests that it's a virus. The other is that there is an environmental cause of some kind or another. Those who suggest that it is a virus are in the Orthodox community. They're the ones who really dominate the conversation. Those who suggest that it could be environmental are pretty much shunned or called denialists and don't really have a place at the government funding table, do they?
That's putting it mildly. You know, I want to make a suggestion. What if we were to hand the answer to that question over to the people who are afflicted, the HIV-positive populations of the world? That is actually who's in my ear. That's who I've been following and listening to. And they want and need this debate to happen. They are walking around under a death sentence every moment of their lives. I want to live to see that death sentence repealed. I don't think it is sound or fair or humane to mark somebody for death when they're still perfectly healthy. The psychological destruction of that is almost incalculable, but I've been listening to people tell me how that has affected them over the years. They stop living. They're still alive, but they stop living. They stop aspiring.
Celia Farber, can you join us next week for a further discussion about this? I'd like to approach the nutrition element that we have yet to discuss. Would you hang with us next week as well?
I would be happy to, and I'd like to have
yes.
a chance to explain what I said about the word love.
You will have that next week. Thank you so much for joining us, folks. This has been The Food Chain. Stay tuned next week for part two of The Defiers. Right back, The Denialists.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.